clear. Crouching as Darnell leaned low in the saddle to try for a decapitating blow with his longsword. Frentice let it whisper past, then dived to catch hold of Darnell's armoured forearm, hooking both arms around the steel-clad limb and hauling him from the saddle. He landed with a crash of rending metal, but recovered quickly, lunging to butt his helmeted head into Frentice's side, sending him sprawling, then bringing his longsword up in a two-handed grip. Frentice could see his eyes behind the visor, wide and full of unreasoning hate. He rolled as the blade came down, cleaving into the earth, springing to his feet and slashing at Darnell's visor. The fieflord dodged the blow and brought his sword around in a great arc, Frentice grunting with the effort as he parried the blow, Darnell's steel biting deep into his order blade. He reached out to catch Darnell's gauntleted wrist before he could draw the blade back, stepping in close, angling his sword to thrust up through the visor. Darnell jerked his head back as the blade sank home, the tip emerging bloodied, the fieflord roaring in fury and pain. Frentice spun, bringing the blade round to slash into Darnell's legs, not piercing the armor, but with enough force to send him to the ground. The fieflord howled and hacked at him again, but Frentice blocked the blow and delivered a kick to his sword hand, the blade flying free. He smashed his sword guard into Darnell's visor, stunning him before planting a boot on his neck, laying the tip of his blade on the opening, meeting the eyes behind it, smiling fiercely at the fear he saw. "Brother!" It was Arundel, charging towards them, men locked in combat on either side, his sword pointed at something over Frentice's shoulder. He didn't waste time with a glance, diving to the left as a Valerian cavalry sword left a shallow cut on his cheek. The Valerian dragged his horse around for another blow, then tumbled from the saddle as Arundel's sword lanced through his shoulder. Frentice turned, finding himself faced with four more Valerians charging at full gallop. He heard the thunder of hooves behind him and threw himself flat, feeling hot breath wash over his neck as a horse leapt him. He looked up to see Master Renciel deliver a precise upward stroke to one of the onrushing Valerians, the man's breastplate parting with the force of the blow. Renciel ducked under a wild slash of the Valerian to his right and replied with a backward stroke as he rode past, the cavalryman arching his back as the blade cut him to the spine. The remaining two Valerians came for Frentice, close together and blades levelled, then tumbling to the ground as a cloud of arrows arched down from the hilltop to claim both riders and horses. Frentice whirled, searching for Darnell amidst the raging chaos. Banda's knights had shattered the fieflord's command, but were now fully engaged with the Valerians, men and horses wheeling in a mass of steel and rending flesh. Frentice caught a flash of blue armour through the heaving confusion to the right, a hunched figure on a horse being led away by two Valerians. Horns sounded, and the cavalry began to withdraw, riders delivering a final slash before turning about and galloping back to the river. Frentice saw a riderless horse a dozen feet away and vaulted onto its back, spurring in the direction of Darnell's flight, hacking at any unfortunate Valerians in his way. He spied Master Renciel nearby, cutting down an unhorsed Valerian, and yelled to get his attention. The master's eyes found him quickly, as ever in battle, focused, calm, and seemingly free of madness. Frentice pointed at the blue-armoured figure now nearing the river, and the master spurred his horse in pursuit, Frentice riding hard on his heels. Darnell was already labouring through the water when Renciel and Frentice caught up with his escort. Both men turning at the water's edge to face them, manoeuvring their mounts with uncanny precision, Frentice grunting in annoyance at the sight of the twin swords on their backs. Curetai. Renciel attempted to skirt them, hanging half out of his saddle to avoid a Curetai's blade. But the slave elite leapt from his horse, landing nimbly on Renciel's saddle and stabbing down with his twin blades. Renciel unhooked his foot from the stirrup and swung himself around his horse's head, delivering a double kick to the Curetai's chest as they ploughed into the river, the slave flying free of the horse and the master regaining the saddle. Frentice tried to dispatch the second Curetai with a throwing knife, waiting until he was near level with the slave before sending it into his eye. The man barely seemed to notice the injury, hacking at Frentice as he rode by, the blade missing by inches, turning his horse to follow, but falling dead as Devoca's spear erupted from his chest. She hauled it free of the corpse and spurred her own horse onward, following Frentice into the river. He could see Darnell ahead, flogging his horse bloody as it laboured onto the far bank, galloping east as an escort of Valerians closed around him and a rear guard stood firm at the water's edge. Renshiel charged straight into them, his sword a blur as men fell around him, spurring after the fast-retreating Darnell, then rearing as a Valerian blade cleaved into his horse's neck. Another Valerian rushed towards the master, sword poised to strike at his back. Francis's horse ploughed into the Valerian's mount before he could strike, his head transfixed by the order blade a second later. Devoca screamed in frustration as she fought her way through the remaining Valerians, spear whirling, blood trailing from the blade, leaving only two remaining cavalrymen, who vainly attempted to follow their comrade's retreat, falling dead to arrows launched from behind. Frentis turned to see Solis and Ivan fording the river at speed, bows in hand. Behind them, the western bank was calm in the aftermath of battle, knights and free fighters wandering among the dead. Frentis cast his gaze back at the dust cloud rising in Darnell's wake, knowing they wouldn't catch him now. Devoca uttered a Lonak curse and threw her spear into the ground. Nearby, Renshiel knelt at his horse's side, smoothing a hand along its neck and whispering softly as it breathed its last. "That was reckless, brother." Solis's pale eyes regarded him with stern disapproval, deepening further as Frentis laughed, long and loud. "Yes, brother," he replied as the mirth faded, knowing the expression on Solis's face to be a mirror of his own when he looked at Renshiel. "Very reckless. My most profound apologies." "We had him," Ermund fumed, hands on his sword hilt, stabbing the scabbard into the earth. "I was less than 2 yards away in the melee. We had him, and still he lives. He's laughing at us. I can hear it. His knights lie dead or captured, and he runs for Varensold like a whipped dog," Banders replied. "I doubt he'll be laughing. Though he does now have full knowledge of our number and whereabouts," Solis pointed out. "But not the strength to do much about it," the Baron returned. They were atop the rocky hill overlooking the spur. Below, Frentis's fighters were moving amongst the dead, looting weapons or valuables. Near the riverbank, a small cluster of Darnell's knights waited under guard. They made a curiously pathetic sight when shorn of armour, just tired, defeated men, eyes wide with fear and nerves frayed by the instant death meted out to those Valerians who had attempted to surrender. "What's these poxed whore sons doing alive, brother?" Draker had demanded of Frentis earlier, the prisoners within earshot and moving in a restless shudder. "Traitors to the realm, ain't they?" "They yielded according to custom," Ermund told him, not without a note of regret. "The Baron will decide their fate." "Best keep him away from us on the march," Draker muttered darkly before stomping off to do some more looting. Banders had extracted enough information from the captured knights to reveal the depth of Darnell's current delusions. "Rebuilding the palace? Making himself a king?" he said, shaking his head. "I'm given to wonder if the Valerians haven't put some dark spell on him, stripping away all reason." "It was always there, father," Lady Ullis said quietly. "This madness. I remember it well enough. As a girl I mistook it for passion, love even. And it may well have been, but love for himself, bound only by his father's will. With Fieflord Theros gone, he feels himself free, able to fly at last." "We'll have to hope his unreason leaves him deaf to Alhestian's counsel," Banders said. "Taking Varen's hold by stealth may well be impossible now, and all he need do is wait behind its walls, whilst his allies conclude their business in Cumbriel." "I should still like to attempt the sewers, my lord," Frentis said. "Alone, if necessary." This drew some odd glances from the assembled captains, Solis's gaze particularly grave in its intensity. Frentis knew his freshly lightened soul showed on his face, but the wolf's gift was a cherished thing, and he saw little reason to hide it. "You must forgive yourself." "I'll be sure to bear that in mind, brother," Banders assured him with the kind of tight smile Frentis recognized. "The smile you offer to one you think mad." "We stand barely a few miles from the Nilsalian border," Lord Furrell said. "A pause here to rest and await word from my messengers might be the best course. Reinforcements could well be marching to our side as we speak. At the very least, some word will be coming from the Reaches. Banders looked at Solis with a questioning eye. "I'll send my brothers out in all directions," the brother commander said. "If there's word to be had within 50 miles of here, we'll have it within 2 days." Banders nodded. "Very well. We camp here. Brother Frentis, you come under your brother's word, not mine. But I think we are of like mind in saying your visit to Varenshold will have to wait." Frentis shrugged, bowing with an affable grin. "As my lord wishes." His smile lingered as he made his way back to his tent. The unease he had felt at the very sight of his bedroll now vanished. A dreamless sleep, he thought, pulling off his boots and lying back on the blanket. I wonder how it'll feel. She watches them fight with cold detachment, assessing skill and speed as they dance in the pit below. Steely echoes rebound from the walls that surround her. The stone roof above, coarse and free of decoration, for these are new pits, chiseled out far below the streets of Olar, the birthplace of long gestated children. "Do you like them, beloved?" she asks him, knowing he sees them, keen to engage his interest, hungry, in fact, to hear a single word from across the gulf that divides them. "We learned so much from you." The men in the pit below fight without restraint and die without screams, but their faces are not those of Curitai. No blank automata here. These men grimace in pain and snarl in fury, register grim satisfaction at bloody victory. There are at least 100 in the pit, moving with all the fluency of those bred to the fight. Give a dog too tight a leash, she thinks, and it chokes. And however much you whip it, it will always be a dog. But these, beloved. She smiles down at the men in the pit. These are lions. She turns away, moving along a stone walkway to a narrow door. The sounds of combat follow her as she walks. The tunnel is long and dark, but she has walked here before and has no need of torches. The chamber she comes to is broad and high, tiered walkways rising on both sides, allowing access to rows of cells, each sealed with bars of iron. She pauses and lets her song wander, feeling the dulled fears emanating from each of the cells. Drugs are widely employed by the overseers who service these cells, but still the fear always lingers. Her song alights on a cell on the middle tier to the left. The note is harsh, somber, stirring a hunger. She is momentarily troubled by this. Usually the song chooses an innocent, some pale-faced youth stolen from a slaughtered hill tribe or identified by the overseers in the training dens. She had liked to play the benefactor, the kindly mistress come to offer them deliverance from this place of endless fear, enjoying the desperate hope in their eyes, even granting them the mercy of a swift death by way of reward. Now it is different. The song speaks of a loathsome soul, and it's this that stirs her hunger. "Was this you, beloved?" she asks him. "Did you change me so much?" Despite her unease, she knows this shell must be sustained. The messenger having related how quickly a stolen shell can sicken. The demands of multiple gifts drain them so. She starts for the nearby stairwell, but pauses as two Curitai approach, dragging a red-clad figure between them and providing a welcome distraction. "Councilman Lorvec," she greets the red-clad. "It's been so very long. I'm glad to see the years have not withered you one bit." The red-clad appears to be a man in his mid-30s, though she first met him some 80 years ago when he first rose to council, in this very chamber, in fact. He had been triumphant then, she recalls, preening with satisfaction at having secured fabled immortality. Now he just seems to be what he is, a scared man, cowed by torture and expectant of death. He begins, swallows, a faint trickle of blood coming from the corner of his mouth. "I humbly regret any offence caused to the ally or his servants." "Oh, there you go again, Lorvec," she says, shaking her head with a sad smile. "Always saying the wrong thing." What was it you called me that day in council? Oh, 20 years ago? You remember, the day I came back from my excursion to the realm of the slant-eyed pig. Lorvec hangs his head, summoning the will to plead further. I said unwise words. Murderous whore to a pestilent phantom. She takes hold of his hair and pulls his head up. Yes, that was unwise. And now you call me a servant. I do wonder how you ever rose so high with such poor judgment, after everything the ally has given you. A wave of weariness sweeps through him, and his eyes grow dim for a second. She assumes he has exhausted his ability to beg, but then he draws breath, a light coming back into his eyes as he spits blood into her face. "The council will not stand for this, you vile bitch," he hisses. "Evidence of corruption is hard to ignore," she tells him, finding a glimmer of admiration for this final flare of courage. "I am afraid the vote was unanimous. Besides," she moves closer, whispering, "just between the two of us, the council won't have to stand for anything soon." She presses a kiss to his cheek and steps back. "Back there," she tells the Curatai, jerking her head at the tunnel leading to the pits. "Give him a sword and throw him in. Tell the overseer I want to know how long he lasts." He screams as they drag him away, more defiance, dwindling again into contrite pleas as they enter the tunnel, and his voice fades. She summons the song once more, seeking out the cell with the dark note and making for the stairs. Frentis came awake with a shout, despair and grief doubling him over. He felt tears flowing and covered his face with his hands, sobs tearing from his throat. "Boy?" Master Rentiel reached out to touch him, hand tentative on his shoulder, bafflement in his voice. "Boy?" Frentis continued to weep as the mad master patted his shoulder, aware that the others had stirred from their tents, that they stood outside looking on in amazement. But he found he couldn't stop. Not until the morning sun rose and all chance of sleep had safely faded. "My blood grandmother had many dreams." Devoka's eyes were intent on his face as she rode alongside, though her tone was light, her usual growl absent this morning. Frentis gave a tired nod and didn't reply. Breakfast had been a mostly silent affair, 34 passing him a bowl of porridge with a troubled frown, Ilion and Arundel unable to meet his gaze, and Draker staring, bushy brows narrowed in concern. "Tears from the Red Brother," Frentis thought. "They forgot I was just a man. Perhaps I did, too." "She saw stars falling from the sky to shatter the land," Devoka went on, "and floods high enough to drown the mountains. One day she gave away her pony and all her goods because a dream told her the sun would explode at twilight. It didn't, and people saw just a mad old woman with dreams, and dreams mean nothing." "They are not dreams," he wanted to tell her, closing his eyes and rubbing at his temples as fatigue swept through him. "You think I'm not fit to lead? Our clan would follow you into the mouth of Nishak if you asked. They fear for you, that is all." He opened his eyes and forced himself to scan the horizon. West of the spur, the ground was mostly pasture, though now devoid of cattle. The grass grown long through lack of grazing. Master Solis had acceded to his request to scout the southern approach, though his pale eyes spoke of harsher judgment than that offered by the people who had followed him from the Earlish. "He thinks me damaged," Frentis knew, "destroyed by the burden of so much guilt." He hadn't told Solis of the wolf's blessing, the liberation from guilt it had brought, for it seemed empty now. What use was there in being freed from guilt if he was condemned to see through her eyes every night? Devoka stiffened at his side and pointed. Frentis shook away the doubts clouding his head and followed her finger, finding two figures on the horizon, both mounted and moving at a steady canter through the long grass. He knew they couldn't be Valerian. They never patrolled in small numbers, and he doubted Darnell had many more hunters to send forth, especially without dogs. Besides, it was plain they had already seen the two riders to the north and came on regardless. Not the actions of an enemy. Nevertheless, he unhitched his bow and notched an arrow as the riders came closer, Devoka edging her horse away and angling it so her spear was concealed, held low on its right flank. Francis frowned as the riders' features came into view, finding one a woman and the other a man. The woman had long hair tied back in a tight braid, mounted on a tall, piebald mare. Her clothes were unfamiliar, a mix of leather and Valerian gear, including a short sword tied to her saddle, though she also carried a lance adorned with feathers and what seemed to be talismans of carved bone. He heard Devoka give a surprised grunt. Erhil. The man was dressed in the garb of Realm Guard infantry, his somewhat gaunt features set in a permanent frown, somewhere between bafflement and pain, his mouth open and lips free of expression. They reined to a halt some 10 yards away, the woman's gaze shifting between them, faintly amused by Frentis and his bow, stern and guarded when she turned to Devoka, the realm guard at her side, sparing them only a tired glance. Devoka said something in an unfamiliar tongue, the words hesitant and formed with difficulty. The Erhil woman barked a laugh before speaking in heavily accented realm tongue. "Lonikim sound like a birthing ape." Devoka bridled, taking a firm grip on her reins and hefting her spear, though the Erhil woman just grinned, turning to Frentis. "My husband teach me, you tongue. You a brother?" "Yes," he said. "Brother Frentis of the Sixth Order, this is Lady Devoka, Lonak ambassadress to the Unified Realm." The Erhil blinked in bafflement at the unfamiliar words and shook her head, patting her chest. "Insha Kaforna, I am Erhil." "We know," Devoka said evenly. "What do you do here?" "This brother Lerniel." The Erhil gestured at the realm guard, who was now staring silently at the ground. "Quinn sent us." "Quinn?" Frentis asked. Insha Kaforna grunted in frustration and turned, pointing towards the south, speaking with slow deliberation. "Queen." Chapter 9. Lerna. The name was halfway down today's list, clearly legible in Brother Holland's neat script. It had become her daily habit to read the list after breakfast, the brother waiting patiently as she scanned every name. She had been gratified to find that he had already compiled a complete list of every subject in her army, apart from the Shorda and Erhil, who reacted to his approaches with baffled disdain. Since arriving at Warnsclave, she had asked him to expand it to include the refugees who continued to trail into the wasted city. The portly brother undertook the task with his usual diligent care, though he had been obliged to expand his staff of scribes to over 30, mostly older folk skilled in letters and poorly suited to soldiering. "These people all arrived yesterday?" she asked. "Yes, Highness. We put them in the western quarter. Shelter is sparse, but Captain Nultin's miners have been busy, bringing in timber to repair roofs and such. They've even begun raising some stone houses from the rubble." "Good. Assign more men to help them." She looked again at the name on the list, recalling the final words of a drowning man. "Don't forget your promise, Highness." She put the list aside and smiled at Holland. She had taken to receiving her subjects in a large room on the second floor of the harbour master's house, a comfortable but somewhat scorched chair standing in for a throne, Iltis and her ladies at her back, with a dutiful stillness she found quite irksome, even though she recognized the necessity for it. A queen must have a court. "This takes us up to some 30,000 new mouths to feed, does it not, brother?" she asked her lord of the queen's purse. 31,620, the brother replied, with customary alacrity. "Thank the departed for Lord Albera, or they'd all be starving." "Quite." Lerna decided not to add that, but for her newly acquired subjects, her army would have been on the march by now. Instead, they were obliged to loiter in this ruin, ensuring the people were fed and training new recruits, fierce in their desire to get out the Valerians, but lacking the strength to march more than a mile. The pickings provided by the Maldinian fleet had been less copious than she had hoped for. Barely a ton of grain so far, though the pirates who came and went from the harbour seemed fairly well attired in silks and jewellery. The shield had yet to make an appearance, though shiplord El-Nurin had arrived the previous day, the deck of the Red Falcon laden with captured arrows, once destined for Varen's Hold. There was a loud rap on the door, and Arena went to open it, revealing Benton lowered to one knee. "Lord Alsorna and Lady Almerna, my queen." She nodded, smiling again at Brother Holland. "I look forward to tomorrow's report, brother." He bowed and moved to the door, standing aside as Valin and the Lady Dorena entered. "I would talk to the Lord and Lady in private," Lona told her court, who duly bowed and withdrew, Iltis with obvious reluctance, as he rarely let her out of his sight these days, but knowing better than to argue the point. Lona watched Valin and Dorena rise in unison, their movements almost as synchronized as those empty-headed Nilsaelin twins. Looking at their matched, neutral expressions, she wondered if they were aware of it, of how unnerving it was to see, or how painful. "The queen is above jealousy," she reminded herself, "though after today they may be forgiven for thinking otherwise." "Lady Dorena," she said, keeping her tone as light and brisk as she could, "I have been pondering your report on the rich gold deposits to be found in the Reaches. From what I can surmise from Brother Holland's estimates, the mines hold enough gold to pay our current and future debts to the Maldinian merchant class, several times over." Dorena gave a short nod. "I believe so, Highness." "Strange that I can recall no instance when King Malsius expressed an awareness of such riches within his realm." The lady's answer was swift and, Dorena judged, well rehearsed. "The full survey of the deposits was not yet complete at the time of the king's tragic demise, Highness. In truth, I suspect there are more seams yet to be found." "I am glad, my lady. Such wealth may well serve as the saviour of this realm in years to come, for we have much work still to do. And yet, it is of scant use to us lying in the ground, hundreds of miles away, whilst the men with the skill to mine it are here, along with one best place to organise their efforts." She saw them stiffen, once again with the same unnerving uniformity. "My queen?" Benin asked in a hard voice. Lerna took a breath, summoning her regretful smile. She had spent a while at the mirror practicing this morning, for it had never been one of her best. "Lady Dorena, it is my hard duty to order your immediate return to the Northern Reaches, where you will exercise the Queen's word until such time as Lord Valin can resume his duties. Shiplord El-Nurin's vessel waits in the harbour to carry you there. With kindly weather, you should reach the North Tower in 3 weeks, his ship being so uncommonly swift. I will also order sufficient vessels gathered to support Captain Ultin's miners home as soon as possible." "They want to fight," Valin stated, Dorena standing expressionless at his side. "Sending them away will cause trouble." "I'll speak to them," Lerna told him. "Explain that every swing of a pick is worth 100 strokes of a sword. Besides, they've done enough fighting to justify any claim to honour, wouldn't you say?" "I would, Highness," Dorena said before Valin could speak. "I regret the necessity of your order." She glanced briefly at Valin before lowering her gaze. "However, I can find no argument against it." "How fortunate, since I will hear no argument from you." Lerna chained the words behind another smile, rising and coming forward to clasp the small woman's hands. "Your service in this war has been great and wondrous. It will never be forgotten, nor is it over. Bring me riches, my lady, so that I might buy justice." She released Dorena's hands and stepped back, forcing herself to meet Valin's gaze, the glint in his narrow gaze hard to bear. "This is not jealousy," she wanted to say. "You know me better than that." "You will wish to say your farewells," she told them. "I have business with our new arrivals." The newcomers were unusual in that, unlike most of the other groups to make their way to Warnsclave over the past week, they were rich in children. One of the most frequent and difficult sights on the march had been the plethora of small corpses, often herded into houses and burned to tiny remnants, others just slaughtered like unwanted livestock and left to rot in the open. Seeing so many still living gave a lift to Lerna's spirits, though they were mostly gaunt and silent, staring at her as she moved among their mean accommodations. "Brother Innes," Brother Holland introduced a thin man in a grey robe, "master of the orphanage at Roundsmill. He hid his charges in the woods for weeks." "Brother, Lerna returned the man's bow with grave respect. I thank you with all my heart. Your deeds credit the faith. Brother Innes, clearly unused to royalty and ill from lack of food, staggered a little but managed to remain upright. The children clustered around him, clutching at his robe, some glaring at Lerna as if she had done him harm. I had a great deal of help, Highness, the brother said, gesturing at the comparatively few adults in the group. These people starved so the children could eat, led the Valerians away so that they might remain undiscovered. Some paid dearly for their courage. They will receive full justice for their sacrifice, she assured him. If you require anything, speak to Brother Holland and it will be provided. He gave another unsteady bow. Thank you, Highness. Now, I seek a woman named Trella Al-Oren. Innes blanched at the name, shooting a guarded glance at a shelter nearby, a roof of thin planking over what had been a woodshed. She gave much to keep these children warm, he stammered. Forgive me, Highness, but I beg that no punishment be visited upon her.
Punishment? Lerna asked.
How may I serve, Highness?
Lerna turned to find a tall woman standing outside the shelter, arms crossed. She was somewhere past her 50th year, handsome features set in a wary frown, and white streaking her black hair.
My lady, Lerna bowed to her, I bring news of your son.
Lady Al-Oren had contrived to preserve a china tea set throughout her ordeal, two small cups and a spherical pot, finely decorated with an orchid motif inlaid with gold.
Alpirin, she said, pouring the tea as they sat outside her shelter. A gift from my aunt on the occasion of my wedding.
Lerna sipped her tea, finding the taste surprisingly rich.
My lady is resourceful, she offered, hoping to ease the woman's obvious tension. To keep such treasures safe, and procure tea of such quality.
We found a merchant's cart a few weeks ago. The owner killed, of course. They took everything but the tea, though a single sack of grain would have been more welcome. She sipped her own tea and sighed, steeling herself to ask the obvious question.
How did he die?
Saving my life, and the lives of those who now make up my court.
But not his own.
My lady, if there had been any way...
Lady Trella shook her head, eyes closed and face downcast.
I kept hold of my hopes, throughout it all, during the flight from Varenshold, the long days on the road, finding Brother Innes and the children. I held to my hope. Firmin was always so clever, if never wise. If there was a way to survive the city's fall and escape the dungeons, he would have found it.
Lerna thought of the shark and the battle, wondering if she should share her suspicions, her belief that Firmin had found at least some form of escape and vengeance. But the words were beyond her, the enigma of it all so great.
Was he a man living in a shark? Or a shark with a memory of once being a man?
In either case, she felt sure this brave woman had no need to be burdened by further mystery.
It is my wish, she said, to make Firmin a posthumous sword of the realm, in honor of his sacrifice.
Lady Trella's lips formed the faintest smile.
Thank you. I think he would have found the notion amusing.
Lerna glanced around at the onlooking people, the adults busying themselves with the chores of cooking or building, but Brother Innes and his clutch of children continuing to view their meeting with deep concern.
Brother Innes said you kept them warm, she said.
Lady Trella shrugged. Anyone can light a fire.
Also, to survive the assault on the city, and the flight southward, quite an achievement.
I don't know how much Firmin told you of our circumstances, Highness, but despite our name, we did not live a noble existence. Poverty makes one resourceful.
I'm sure.
But still, a woman alone, surviving war and hunger for so long.
She watched Lady Trella sip more tea, seeing how she forced herself to swallow.
You may have heard, she went on, that I have lifted all strictures on use of the dark in this realm. The gifted now occupy an honored place in my army, and upon speaking to them, I have noticed that they share a common trait. In each case, their mother also had a gift, but not always their father. Curious, don't you think?
Lady Trella met her gaze, then slowly raised her hand, splaying the fingers.
A Valerian soldier kicked my door in that night, found me hiding in my bedroom closet. Laughed as he took hold of my hair and made ready to cut my throat.
A small blue flame appeared on the tip of her index finger, dancing prettily. He didn't laugh for long. The flame turned yellow and flared, engulfing Trella's hand from fingers to wrist.
"Highness!"
Iltis appeared at her side, sword half-drawn. Lerna realized she had risen and backed away, staring at the flames.
"I know of your edict, Highness," Trella said, "but mere words do not dispel centuries of fear. My mother made certain I knew well the danger of revealing my nature, the terror it aroused, and the unwelcome attention it drew from the faithful." She closed her hand, and the flames died. Lerna took a breath, forcing the tremble from her limbs. She gave a nod of reassurance to Iltis and resumed her seat, sipping some more tea until the memories faded. The smell of her own skin as the flames licked over it.
"The Seventh Order is bound by my word," she said after a moment, when she was sure there would be no quaver to her voice. "I will not allow them to compel any subject to join it. There is a small company of gifted from the northern reaches who stand apart from them, answering only to Lord Valen and myself. You would be welcome to join them."
"I am an old woman, Highness."
"Not so old, I think. And I feel your son's soul would smile on your service, don't you?" Trella's eyes went to the children standing nearby.
"I have obligations here, Highness."
"These children will be well cared for. You have my word on it. They have no more need of your fire, but I do." Something must have colored her voice then, because the wariness on Trella's face deepened, her eyes taking on the guarded cast Lerna was seeing more often on a few select faces. Norta, Darenna, Reva, Valen. Those not in awe see more clearly.
"I make no command," Lerna added with a smile, "merely a queen's request. Think on it a while. Meet with Aspect Canis or the folk from the Reaches. I am sure either would welcome you."
"I will, Highness." Trella bowed as Lerna rose. "One more thing. If I may crave a boon."
"Of course."
"My son's sigil." The lady's eyes were bright with tears now, the children coming to her side as they sensed her distress. "I should like it to be a weasel. Of all the little beasts that followed him home, they were his favorite."
"As my lady wishes,"
Lerna assured her with a bow. Better a weasel than a shark. Although much of Warnsclave had been destroyed down to its cobbled streets, the infrastructure below the town remained largely intact, numerous cellars providing useful additional shelter and places of confinement. The Valerian woman had been secured in the coal cellar of what had once been a blacksmith's shop, judging by the soot-covered anvil sitting amidst the rubble. Two realm guards stood outside the steps, leading down to the cellar, whilst Lord Verniers waited, resting on the anvil as she approached, scribbling away in a small notebook. He rose on seeing her, bowing with his usual fluency and greeting her in realm tongue, uncoloured by even the trace of an accent.
"Highness, my thanks on granting my request."
"Not at all, my lord," she replied. "However, I feel I have brought you here on a false premise."
"Highness?"
Lerna gestured for the guards to open the door to the cellar.
"Yes, my lord. I know you are keen for my knowledge to add to your history, but I regret scholarship will have to wait upon the needs of diplomacy."
She bade him follow her down the steps, Iltis preceding her into the darkness. Fonella av Entril av Tokrev sat at a small table, reading by the light of a single candle. She wore no chains, and her face and hair were clean, Lerna having allowed her a bowl of water each morning for ablutions. She had also been provided with parchment and ink, the table before her covered with a scroll inscribed from end to end in neat Valerian. Fonella rose and bowed as Lerna entered, her face impassive until she saw Lord Verniers, whereupon she favoured him with a cautious smile.
"Highness, my lord," she said in her basic realm tongue, "two visitors, I am honoured."
"We will speak in your own tongue," Lerna told her, dropping into Valerian. "It is important there be no misunderstanding between us." She told Iltis to wait outside, and gestured for Fenella to sit, moving to the table and scanning the scroll she had written, finding it a list of names, places, and goods, each name marked with a circular symbol Lerna recognized.
"A writ of manumission," she said. "These are your slaves, I take it."
"Yes, Highness, though the document is in fact a will. The slaves are to be freed upon my death. My understanding of Valyrian law is limited, Lerna lied, but I believe the slave, regardless of owner or importance, can only be freed by special edict of the ruling council. Quite so, but my brother sits on the council. I have little doubt he will accede to my wishes in this. By the time he hears of your death, Lerna thought, I expect he'll be too preoccupied with the imminence of his own demise to care about your final wish. Am I to take it, she asked instead, that your liking for your empire's principal institution has waned recently? Fenella glanced at Vernius, the scholar standing rigidly against the cellar wall and refusing to meet her gaze. We have made many mistakes, the Valyrian woman said. Slavery is perhaps the worst, only surpassed by our bargain with the ally. A bargain that, if Lord Vernius' account is to be believed, has provided you with several centuries of life. Not life, Highness. Merely existence. And how is it achieved, all these additional years? Fenella lowered her gaze, and for the first time Lerna had a sense of her true age in the faint lines now visible around her shrouded eyes. Blood, Fenella said after a moment, her voice no more than a murmur, the blood of the gifted. Lerna's memory flashed to the ship, the overseer prowling the slave deck, whip coiled. All here, trade for one with magic. She moved closer to the table, her fists resting on the surface as she leaned towards Fenella, the Valyrian woman's face still lowered. You drink the blood of the gifted, she grated. That is where your years come from. There is a place, Fenella said in a whisper, a great chamber beneath Volar, hundreds of cells filled with gifted. Those who are party to the bargain go there once a year, to drink. And every year there are more empty cells, and always more redclads clamoring to share in the ally's blessing. And so you need more, and the ally promised you would find them in this realm. That is why you came here. And to secure a northern front for the Alperin invasion, as I said. But yes, the ally promised this land would be rich in gifted blood. And when that was all gone, and the Alperin lands also stripped, what then? Send your armies forth to rape the whole world? Fenella's head rose, her eyes steady, though her voice was uneven, the voice of a woman facing her final moments. Yes. In time he promised the world would be ours. Is it shame I see in your eyes, Lerna wondered, or just disappointment? I assume it was the promise of endless life that seduced Lord Darnell to your cause, she asked. Fenella gave a rueful shrug. The lure of immortality is hard to resist, especially for a man in love with himself. Lerna moved back from the table, turning to Vernius. My lord, do you find this woman's words to be truthful? Vernius forced himself to look at Fenella in reluctant but close appraisal. I doubt she has lied, Highness, he said. Even as her slave, I found honesty to be her only interesting quality. And do you think your emperor would find her believable? The Emperor is wiser than I in all respects. If she speaks truly, he will hear it. And, I hope, understand the value of forgetting past differences. Vernius' face was grave as he met her gaze. There is much to forget, Highness. And a world to fall if we cannot forge common purpose. She turned back to Fenella. There is a man in Brother Canis's order who can hear lies. You will state to him your willingness to travel to Alpira with Lord Vernius, where you will tell the Emperor all you have told me. If he hears a lie, honored citizen, he will not, Highness. Fenella's relief was palpable, her years showing again in the sag of her mouth. I will do as you ask. Very well. Lerna looked at Vernius, summoning her regretful smile. And you, my lord? Will you do this for me? No, Highness, he replied, the even tone of his voice and narrowness of his gaze making it clear her smile was a wasted effort. This one sees far too much. I will do it, Vernius went on, for my emperor, who is great in his wisdom and benevolence. She stood on the roof of the harbour master's house to watch the ships leave, seeing Valen's farewell to Darenna, finding herself unable to look away, even though she felt like an intruder. He held her for such a long time. The small woman moved back from him, exchanged farewells with Lady Alornis, Lord Adal, Brother Kellen, and Sanish Poltar, then turned and walked the gangplank to the Red Falcon, shiplord El-Nurin greeting her with a bow. As the ship made for the harbour mouth, Lerna wondered if there was any significance in the fact that not a single Sjorda had come to see her off. Beren stayed to watch the ship sail away, responding to his sister's embrace with a slight shake of the head before she and the others drifted away. After a while, Lord Verniers and the Valerian woman arrived, and she saw him escort them to the ship. She was still puzzled over the interest he had shown in choosing the vessel to carry them to the Empire, but he was ever a man of secrets. She turned as Orenna climbed onto the roof, bearing a fur-trimmed cloak. "The wind is harsh today, Highness." Lerna nodded her thanks as the lady placed the cloak over her shoulders, still watching him as he stared after the departing scholar. "Muriel says he's the most frightening man she's ever met," Orenna mused softly. "Then there is wisdom in the young," Lerna said. "Does he frighten you, my lady?" Orenna shrugged. Of all her attendants, she was the least given to formality when they were alone, something Lerna found sufficiently refreshing to forgive her often wayward tongue. "Some men are brutes, some are kind. Every once in a while you meet one who's both." She straightened, then gave a formal bow. "Lord Marshal Travick craves an audience, Highness. It seems his new recruits are squabbling over what to name their regiments." "I'll be there directly, my lady." Alone again, she waited and watched as he turned back from the harbour, walking away with a purposeful gait. It wasn't jealousy, she thought. "I can permit you no distractions, my lord." She was awoken in the small hours by Muriel's soft but insistent hand. There had been no dreams tonight, and wrenching herself from an untroubled sleep birthed a foul mood. "What is it?" she snapped. "Lord Valin is downstairs, Highness, with Captain Belorath. It seems he bears an important message from the Isles." Lerna ordered her to fetch a bowl of cold water and plunged her face into it, gasping at the instant headache as the lingering tiredness vanished. She dressed in her simplest robe and managed to summon a welcoming visage by the time she descended the steps to her makeshift throne room. Captain Belorath matched Valin's bow, though his face betrayed his discomfort at finding himself in a servile position to a woman once his captive. A captive he had come close to killing. After the shield took over the monstrous Valerian flagship, Belorath had resumed command of the Sea Saber, sailing back to the Isles for repairs and to impart news of the great victory at Altor. Also, Lerna had hoped, to fetch more ships for the fleet. "My Lord Captain," she greeted them, settling into her throne, "I trust the news is grave enough to justify the lateness of the hour." "Indeed, Highness," Valin said, nodding at Belorath. The captain's face betrayed a certain reluctance as he spoke, the tone clipped and careful. "As your Highness knows, the shiplords have been keen to ensure the security of the Isles through certain discreet measures." "You've had spies planted in this realm for years, Captain," Lerna broke in, "a fact not unknown to the late king or myself." "Yes, Highness. Most have fallen silent since the invasion. However, we have continued to receive occasional intelligence from one in Varenshold." "The one who warned the Valerian fleet had sailed," Lerna recalled. "Quite so. Upon returning to the Isles, I found another message had arrived from the same source." Belorath pulled a scroll from his belt and came forward to hand it to her. "It's addressed to you, Highness." Lerna unfurled the scroll, finding the words scant, but enough to make her wonder if, for all her vaunted intelligence, she wasn't just a fool after all. "Lerna, attack on Winterfall Eve. Avoid the walls if you can. Aspects E and D in Blackhold. I'm sorry. Eleusius." Chapter 10. Eleusius. "Don't lie to me, little poet." Dynel glowered at him, his voice low and filled with dire promise. The recently stitched cut below his eye threatening to split as he snarled. "They must have told you something." Eleusius spread his hands in a helpless gesture. "No more than regret at the passing of a brother in the faith, my lord. Though I did sense a certain satisfaction from Aspect Dendrish at finally becoming the fattest man in Asrael. Darnell rose from his throne, his hand going to his sword, face red with fury. He halted when Division Commander Mervek gave a warning cough, and Eleusis's father stiffened, stepping closer to his son's side. Darnell's gaze swept around them all, his hand quivering on his sword handle. His recent flight from the Red Brother and the news that his fief was now raised in rebellion had done little to improve his temperament. Also, Mervek's increasing disregard and deference to his battle lord provided ample evidence of Darnell's burgeoning irrelevance. Only a handful of his knights remained, and there were no more to be had in his fief. Eleusis wondered why the Valerian didn't simply have Darnell killed and assume command himself. But the man was clearly a soldier to his core, and would continue to follow orders until contrary word came from the council. Darnell was their appointed vassal, and Mervek lacked the authority to depose him, however useless he had become. "They know of more gifted," Darnell told the Valerian, failing to keep a desperate note from his voice. "I'm sure of it." "Not so much a fool he doesn't know his stock has fallen," Eleusis realized, watching Darnell fidget. "Seeking to buy security with the Aspect's knowledge." "The Aspects are precious to all those still free in these lands," Eleusis's father said. "Harming them in any way invites further rebellion." "His people rebel in any case," Mervek pointed out in a reflective tone. "These aspects of yours are intriguing. The warrior aspect intriguing enough, the council ordered him shipped back to the Empire the day he was captured. Questioning them could prove fruitful." Eleusis didn't like the weight the Valerian placed on the word questioning. "If you'll allow me more time," he said, "I'm sure they will prove more accommodating. Aspect Dendrish in particular would probably spill every secret in his head for a full dinner." Mervek failed to laugh, regarding him with a narrow gaze. Up until now, his attitude to his slave general's son had been one of vague contempt, but now Eleusis knew he was seeing him with uncomfortable clarity. "My most able questioner was taken by your Red Brother," the Valerian said. "He could have had them talking in seconds. I have sent for a replacement, arriving with our reinforcements by the week's end. You have until their arrival." Eleusis replied with a grateful bow, backing away as the Valerian dismissed him with a flick of his hand. He could feel Darnell's eyes on him as he made his way from the throne room and once again wondered at his complete absence of fear. "Well," Eleusis said as Sister Cressia panted in his ear, her naked form atop him, trembling a little. "That was unexpected." She levered herself off him, turning her back and reaching for her blouse. "I haven't spent my entire life skulking here," she said. "I was bored. Don't fall in love with me, poet." He forced away an image of Alornish's face, hiding guilt in a laugh. "Trust me, sister. I need no such instruction." Sister Cressia shot him a sharp glance and rose from the pile of furs where she made her bed. She had said nothing when he made his way down here once again, inclining her head at a side passage and leading him to her chamber, shrugging her clothes off and standing naked with a questioning look. Eleusis had glanced at 27, standing in the passage outside, his blank gaze seemingly fixed on the fine brickwork. Cressia's brother and sister were off somewhere in the nighttime streets above, gathering knowledge and supplies, she said, though he had brought sufficient to last them until Winterfall Eve. After that, a lack of provisions was likely to be the least of their concerns. "Who was she?" Cressia asked, her tone lightly curious. "Who was who?" "The woman you were thinking of a few moments ago." She fastened the belt to her trews and sat to pull on her boots. "Is that her design?" he wondered. "Seeking to garner knowledge through intimacy? She's as much a spy as I am." "How could any man think of another when in your arms, my lady?" he replied, sitting up. He felt her flinch at his caustic tone and felt a pang of regret. "I always hurt them," he recalled, thinking back over the years, the girls drawn to the handsome poet with a sad smile, the sweet embraces and the inevitable tears. Alornis was the only woman he had never contrived to disappoint, and he had never even kissed her. "If you require intelligence from me," he told Cressia, "it might be simpler and less time-consuming to just ask." She rose and tossed him his shirt. "Very well. When my brother and sister return, and I'll expect a full account if we're to help in this escapade of yours." They ate a sparse meal of dried beef and bread, washed down with water, since his father hadn't seen fit to provide wine with the extra provisions. If Inella and Relkin sensed any tension between them, they failed to show it, though he fancied there was a faint glint of amusement in the glance Inella gave her sister. "How can you be certain the Queen's army will attack on Winterfall Eve?" Relkin asked when the meal was done. "I can't," Aloysius admitted. "The only surety I can give is that I sent word for them to do so."
"How?"
Cressia asked.
"By pigeon.
My last, in fact. So please don't ask me to send any more."
"How does a poet come to keep pigeons?"
"Because he's also a spy in service to the Meldinian shiplords." Aloysius sipped his water, sighing in fond remembrance of his last taste of decent wine, as the others stared in silence. It had been a bottle from his father's cellar, one of his oldest, Cambrelin, naturally, a deep and richly flavoured red from the southern vineyards. The bottle had been pleasant, but not enough to see him to the sleep he craved, plagued as he was by the ache left by Lornus's departure to the Reaches. So he had sought out a bottle of brandy from the kitchens, falling into bed only to be roused some hours later by a Valerian army.
"Then you," Sister Cressia said, breaking through his reminiscence, "are a traitor to this realm."
Aloysius noted her hand and moved to the leather pouch on her belt, whilst Brother Relkin was now turned towards 27, poised no doubt to employ his gift.
"I suppose so," Aloysius said.
He looked at his cup of water and grimaced, putting it aside. Cressia continued to glare as the silence thickened.
"Why?"
she asked eventually.
"That is not your concern," Aloysius stated.
"What matters is that we have a common interest in ensuring this city is recovered for the realm, with a minimum of bloodshed. And at present, I stand best placed to achieve this outcome."
"A spy deserves no trust."
"Trust? You speak of trust," Aloysius laughed.
"You who have lived a lifetime of lies?
What service have you done in the name of the faith, I wonder? How much blood spilled in the shadows over the years?"
Inella's rat scurried along the table, sniffing his hand, then baring his teeth with a loud squeak.
"Does he smell a lie?" Cressia asked her. The plump sister shook her head, her expression dark.
"No, only this one's contempt for us."
Cressia's face registered a scowl of fury before she forced it to a neutral frown, her hand retreating from her pouch. Inella's rat gave a final squeak, then ran back to its mistress as Brother Relkin turned away from 27.
"How is it to be done?"
Cressia asked Aloysius.
"The Valerian reinforcements are due to arrive on Winterfall Eve," he said,
"to be greeted at the docks by Commander Mervec, Lord Darnell, and my father. I doubt any will object, or notice if I'm there. I shall require your sister's skill to create sufficient diversion."
"Diversion from what?"
"This city will stand or fall on my father's judgment. Without it, Darnell and his allies are doomed."
"A hard thing for a son to kill a father,"
Relkin observed.
"If you doubt my ability to do this," Aloysius replied, "you should kill me now and keep skulking here until Queen Lerna arrives."
He saw the man's dislike in his cold glare and found himself beyond caring.
"I'll need you and Sister Cressia to secure the aspects."
"Breaking into the black hole is no easy task," Cressia said,
"but within your abilities, I'm sure.
I have little doubt their guards have orders to kill them should the city fall, and it's better to risk death than blindly accept it." He saw them exchanging glances, reaching agreement in silent nods, Cressius the most reluctant.
"We'll do this," she said,
"but when it's done, poet, you will not be spared an accounting."
"No."
He got up and turned away, walking back to the tunnel with 27 falling in behind.
"I don't imagine I will."
"I must say, Aspect," he said, sitting on the bunk beside her, "I found the wine rather bitter."
"But you did find it?"
she asked, her gaze intent.
"Indeed I did.
Only 3 bottles, though." Her mouth twitched in suppressed disappointment.
"Pity."
"Disappointment was ever my lot, Aspect. I do, however, have news. It seems we have a new queen."
"Lerna? She lives?"
"Hale, whole, and leading an army to our salvation as we speak, an army commanded by Lord Alsona himself, having crushed General Tokriv at Altor." Aspectalera sat straight, closing her eyes, her shoulders pulled back as she breathed a series of controlled breaths. He had seen her do this before, when her usual composure